Hello and welcome to Deep Dive MH370. This is episode 28, Magic. My name is Jeff Wise. I'm an aviation journalist. I'm the author of the book, The Taking of MH370. You might also know me from the Netflix special, MH370, The Plane That Disappeared. This is a special episode today because Andy is on vacation. For the first time, I'm helming this podcast by myself, which is a little scary. So cut me some slack, please. We'll see how it goes. You know, it's a pretty common thing for co-hosts of podcasts to take sort of alternating vacations and take time off. So, you know, we're venturing to new waters, but, you know, knock on wood, hopefully it'll go okay. So apart from that, I'm really excited for today's episode to be talking about really two things that I'm really interested in. One is brand new. And one is an old favorite. The new one has to do with a viral YouTube video that just dropped about a week ago, and it's gotten 2 million viewers already. So this is really having an influence on the discourse. It's by a very popular podcaster named Mentor Pilot. And it involves a new technology called Whisper, WSPR. A lot of listeners and viewers have been asking me about it. So we're going to dive into it a little bit today. But first, we're going to talk about a topic that, I've been fascinated by for years, and that's the topic of stage magic and what it can possibly tell us about the mystery of MH370. And when you're trying to solve a problem, you have to have the right tool for that problem. If you're a homeowner and you've got some leaks, some leaking drips, you probably are going to need plumbing tools. And if you find some sawdust accumulating by the edge of your baseboard, you're probably going to need some insecticide because you probably have carpenter ants. You know, for the last 10 years, the conversation about MH370 has been dominated mostly by engineers, scientists, airplane pilots. And the net result is that they haven't found the plane. So today we're going to look at, well, is there another lens we can look at this case through? You know, when you have an object disappearing into thin air, it sounds to me like maybe it's a job for a magician, because that's what magicians do. They make things disappear. And I've been thinking about the Penn and Teller show where they have magicians perform their acts and then they try to figure out what the trick is. And so what I've got today for you is a very interesting guest. His name is Ed Denzel. Am I pronouncing that right, Ed? Denzel.
First accent is on the first syllable.
Denzel. That's fine. Yeah, you know, we've Denzel been emailing Washington. And talking, but I've never said you had your email.
Yeah, Denzel Washington has ruined it for my family.
Denzel.
The mispronunciation of our last name has gone along with it. Denzel. Yeah, that's fine. Denzel. That's
anyway.
Yes.
So anyway, you are the host of an excellent podcast.
Thanks.
Called Unfound. And we'll put a link in the show notes.
Thank you.
But you have examined hundreds of mysterious disappearances, mostly missing persons, right?
Missing people, yes. I've covered missing of two jets, including Flight 370. The other one was from Africa in 2003. But yes.
So you had, I was on your show. Actually, yep. I think you were saying I was one of the first people on your show.
Yeah, first 25 probably.
And in the course of our discussions over the years, I learned that you were involved in stage magic. You were the stage manager for a show called The World's Greatest Magic Show at the Greek Isles in Las Vegas from 2005 to 2008.
That's right. That's correct.
You worked with more than 50 magicians, which is, so you spent a lot of time really. And so what exactly, how were you helping them? What was your role in the show?
Yeah, from 2005 to 2008, when the show ended, it was at the Greek Isle, which isn't there anymore. I assisted many different magicians. We had like the magicians that were in every show, but then we would have guest magicians come in for maybe a week or two. So over that time, I would say it was probably about 50 different magicians over the course of about 4 years. And that totals about, I don't know, we never took a day off. I mean, it is Vegas, except for like the Super Bowl. So 1,000 magic shows maybe I worked on as a stage manager, making sure all the props go in the right proper places, because it's a well-oiled machine for a magic show, because every prop or whatever else has to be in the proper place at the proper time where the trick doesn't work. And, you know, a few second delay here and there can really ruin something, really expose something. And so, yeah, that was one of the, that was a job that I had as stage manager for those 4 years. Yeah.
Which is so interesting because you really know literally the mechanics of how to make an act of deception work,
yes,
what doesn't work, how to spoil it. You know, MH370 is like a magic trick because it leaves us baffled, right? The authorities are sure they know exactly what happened to the plane, but then it's not there. In a magic trick, you see the magician put the rabbit in the hat, but then he waves his wand and it's not there anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the essence of magic is contradiction, right? You have a story in your mind. There's sort of the A part. The A part is the, you see the rabbit go into the hat.
Yeah.
And then he waves his wand and you get to the B part, which is the rabbit isn't there. So you have these two contradictory beliefs,
yep,
that you're 100% sure are both right and that they contradict each other. And so your brain is like, wow, I can't make sense, yeah, of this, right?
Yeah, but magic, once again, for everybody, I'm not a magician, but I've just worked,
right,
several years ago with many spectacular magicians that have performed at the White House, that have been on America's Got Talent, a variety of places, very well-known professional magicians. And yeah, it's a lot of work that goes into this and tricking people and making things look possible that are impossible.
Yeah. And so, you know, we tend to think of the job of the magician as making the rabbit disappear. But there's a subtler part of it too, which I think the public doesn't focus on so much. And that's not by accident, because the magician doesn't really want them to think about it, but that he has to make them believe in a story that will then get contradicted. So he has to make them think that the rabbit went to the hat in the first place. He has to lead them to a story that's wrong without them realizing it, right? And so, you know, you and I were talking earlier, and it's like he might have a brass ring, and he wants the audience to have in their head a very solid understanding that this ring is solid. And so he'll like tap it with his wand. He might say this is a solid ring, or he might just tap it and they can see for themselves, right? So he's creating. He's creating expectation, I guess you could say.
Yeah. I would think, you know, if we're going to compare Flight 370 to a magic trick, yeah, I would compare it to the kind that I, in my own show, the show that I worked on, and I've seen it done on TV and elsewhere, where the magician looks like he makes himself disappear, like he goes off stage, and then all of a sudden he's back in the middle of the stage.
Right,
misleading people, right, to look one direction when really he might not have left the stage at all, or might have gone,
right,
in a different direction. This is, and we had a, and I know how that's pulled off. We're not going to reveal any magic tricks today, but
yeah,
that's the kind of trick that I think of when I think of Flight 370.
So you wrote a guest post for me on my blog, mm-hmm, in 2019 that was fascinating to me. And mm-hmm, one of the points you made was that there's often aspects of the trick that seem to have no particular significance to the audience, but that are crucial for the trick's success. And like,
right,
we're very used to a magician coming out with a cape. And, you know, we thought, oh, he's a magician. He wears a cape, like no big deal. He's just being theatrical. Maybe he's like referencing the 19th century. But actually the cape is crucial because like if he was just doing it in like a form-fitting, you know, tank top, he wouldn't be able to hide the things that he's doing, right?
Right.
And you were telling me about David. I think David. Could you tell me about David Copperfield?
He pulled off a trick where it made it look like he walked through the Great Wall of China.
Right.
And then when you really look at it in retrospect, well, why did this? Why did he use, for example, the same, was it stairs or platform for both sides of it? Why didn't he just have two platforms, one on each side? Well,
right,
that's kind of the reveal to it. So what
you don't want to give the reveal, but just suffice to say that like the audience says, okay, the platform goes up to the wall. David Copperfield goes up the platform sort of,
yes,
into the wall or something.
Yes.
And then the platform gets wheeled around to the other side of the wall.
Yes.
And then he comes out of the wall. And
that's
so
right,
to the audience, it's like, well, he's trying to save money. He only has money for
that's
one
right,
platform.
That's right.
And so it's like, no big deal. But like from a magician, you're like, oh, come on. You didn't have a...
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, he lives. I've seen his house. Yeah, he can afford another platform.
Okay, great, great. So I think listeners can get a sense of where we're going with this. It's like when things, there's things that like, if you stop and think about it, which I think a big part of magic is not letting the audience stop and think about it, but stop and think about it. It's like this aspect, which seems a little bit funny, but actually might just be crucial to the whole thing. You know, one of the reasons I got started on down this whole path of thinking was there was an article that the famous magician Teller wrote in Smithsonian Magazine. I don't know if you've ever worked with either him Penn. They're very interesting guys. Very, very successful and theatrical and entertaining.
Sure.
But in Teller, in this article, who's normally doesn't talk, but he's obviously that's just part of his act. But he's very, very, he has very interesting things to say about the practice and art of magic. And he makes the point, he talks about sort of magic, stage magic, as applied psychology. And he makes some points from that perspective that I think were saying. One in particular has really stuck with me. And I actually just want to read you this paragraph, sort of tediously, but here we go. He wrote, "Nothing fools you better than the lie you tell yourself. David P. Abbott was an Omaha magician who used to make a golden ball float around in his parlor. After the show, Abbott would absent-mindedly leave the ball on a bookshelf while he went to the kitchen for refreshments. Guests would sneak over, heft the ball, and find it was much heavier than a thread could support, so they were mystified. But the ball the audience had seen floating weighed only 5 ounces. The one on the bookshelf was a heavy duplicate left out to entice the curious. When a magician lets you notice something on your own, his lie becomes impenetrable." And that really stuck with me. And I think people who are students of MH270 will understand why. Because the entire case revolves around signals that the scientists discovered and believed that nobody could have created these. They must have found them themselves. So the lie becomes impenetrable when you feel like you found it yourself.
Yeah, and what I learned, I knew nothing about magic before working for the world's greatest magic show, and it certainly was an education on how to mislead people. And nothing you see on the stage is real. No matter how much it may seem to be real, except for the actual human walking around, everything else is part of the act. Everything else from the clothes, the music, the props, the assistants, the dancers, the pretty women who dance around or whoever, it's all part of the act to distract, deflect, mislead you, everything.
Yeah. Right, right. There's a bunch of things about MH370. That seems strange, that seem to have no particular significance, but are just kind of weird when viewed by an engineer or pilot, but potentially quite interesting from a stage magic perspective. And one of the things I'm thinking about is the turn back. Like if the pilot, the captain really took the plane and just wanted to disappear, the simplest thing would be just to keep going east, go out over the Marianas Trench. There's no radar, there's nothing. They'll never find you, just, you know. But instead, what he did is he reversed course and he flew back over an Air Force base.
Yep.
And so that's one thing that's like a little odd. And then the other thing is that this box gets turned back on. Mm-hmm. And this is, nobody really has provided a good explanation for why this box got turned back on, but it provides all the clues, right?
Yes.
And so the official investigators, their attitude was, okay, well, let's figure out what these signals mean. They spent no time at all asking themselves, well, how unusual and random is it that this box just got turned on? And so that's something that a magician will do, right? Is kind
that's
of like
right.
present, just leave something for people to chew over.
That's exactly right. And once again, sometimes magicians, the ones I worked with, that will do the trick and still the audience is still puzzled by something that's like the trick isn't totally resolved. Yes, maybe the woman has been cut in half and then she's back together, but there might have actually been something also tricky about the trick that the magician never reveals at all, that just leaves them maybe wanting more. You know, as an entertainer, you always got to leave your audience wanting more.
Right. So there could be like a second twist to it or something.
Yes. Right.
Right.
That's right.
You know, another aspect of MH370, I'm not sure how much this your magic insight will bear on this, but there's a lot of ambiguity, right? Like this plane flew in such a way that once it was generating these signals, those signals were the only source of information about this, about the plane. There was no, it wasn't flying over ground where it could be seen. It wasn't on anybody's primary radar. Right. It all was from this one perspective. And you and I had been talking earlier about how there's some kinds of tricks you can only do in certain settings because you can't allow, like a trick might work on a stage.
Yes.
But you can't do it like in a crowd of people because people, if they look at it from sideways, they'll be able to see what you're doing.
That's right.
You have to control what the audience perceives. Yeah.
Right. That's right. For example, like card tricks. You can do those at birthday parties. You can do them on stage. You can do them in arenas. You can do them anywhere in between. But for example, of course, going back to the stereotypical sawing a woman in half, you can't do that where people are within 2 feet of the magician, whereas you can do all sorts of card tricks with people right in your face. So yes, you have to pick the venue, the particular trick for the particular venue. And picking the wrong trick in the wrong venue will, of course, get the trick exposed. Yes.
Right. So this plane flew to a point over the ocean where it was essentially like being on stage far from the observers. Like there's only, you only have this one very narrow perspective on it. And the official investigators sort of assumed, well, it was just coincidence or who knows. It just worked out that way.
Yeah.
And yet, from a stage magic perspective, well, that's no accident. It's actually exactly what you would want to do if you wanted to pull a sleight of hand and not have a second confirm, like a second sort of pipeline of information that would confirm
it. Maybe a good example, I think, is what I read. And I did go back, I think, Jeff, before we started, I told you I went back and read what I had written back. It's like 5 years ago now, is that Flight 370, if we're to believe that there was a misleading here and the plane went one direction, it went north instead of south. This is not a trick, quote unquote trick. Of course, we know many people are missing. It's tragic. It's very sad. You couldn't do this over the middle of the United States. This was not something that would, a trick, quote unquote, that you could do in the middle of the United States. Too many radars, too many military bases, too much technology. It's people can just look up in the sky and see a jet on a clear night, whether it's in Kansas, Nebraska, or whatever. You can only do this in a particular area on the globe. Yeah.
Yeah. And in this case, we're also talking about how if there's a route and a mirror and it's ambiguous as to which one is the route and which one is the mirror.
That's right.
The plane flew to a place where the mirror was in the middle of the ocean. If it had been over the middle of Australia or in the middle of, Singapore or Tokyo, then the whole thing wouldn't have worked. It had to be flown. It had to start. The trick had to start from a place where there was an ambiguity in the.
Right. In and the it's interesting location. You bring up mirror because mirrors are usually something that magicians use quite often more than the public realizes. And guess what? Wow. The mirror is usually what hides the trick.
Oh my God. So I never thought about that.
Yes.
Ed, I've been thinking about MH370 for 10 years. I never thought about the mirror idea.
Yes, the mirror is usually what hides a lot of things. You can do a lot of things with mirrors on stage that you can never pull off somebody close, but 20, 30, 40 feet away from an audience with mirrors, you can hide a lot of stuff. Yeah.
That's amazing. And again, it has to be from far enough away that they can't tell that there's a mirror there. That's interesting. Now,
I guess what I would also say regarding the pings, the BTO and BFO data and the pings and the handshakes and everything, all of that stuff is a lot easier to be faked than a jet, seeing a jet or something. Anybody could probably fake signals. We don't have Radio Shacks anymore. But if we, order the parts from Amazon or wherever online, you could fake all sorts of signals. It's not difficult.
No, exactly.
But try to build a Boeing 777.
Yeah, it's not so easy. Now, there's an aspect of MH370 that I don't know if it has a counterpart in magic, but which is the idea that the story that the audience believes gets reinforced. You might think that the contradictory evidence, in this case, the plane's absence from the seabed, might make people start to wonder if the consensus narrative is correct. But what we get from the mainstream media and social media is that this idea of getting hammered again and again and again is we keep hearing videos and documentaries saying that the plane must have gone south, and pretty much overlooking the fact that that hypothesis has pretty much been falsified by the absence of wreckage on the seabed. Do magicians ever have some equivalent of this where like they present that sort of that A part of the story to the audience and then somehow reinforce it or make it or sort of add to, you know, kind of make them, well, you know, in the teller story where he does the trick and then he leaves the ball. I mean, you could sort of think of that part of the trick as like he's reinforcing their belief that it can't just be floating on a string.
Right.
I don't know if that's like a common
misleading
thing.
And yeah, I mean, how do you make, I don't know how heavy the fake ball was, but you certainly couldn't make that hover, you know, with thread. Sure.
Yeah. The reason I bring it up is because I this is my clumsy attempt at a segue, which is to the second part of the show, which is I wanted to talk about a viral video that you actually had emailed me about. Yep. Because you often offer me really interesting insights about things as we go.
Thanks.
And this is a YouTuber named Mentor Pilot, and we're recording this in March of 2024. And this video actually just it only dropped like a week ago, and it already has over 2 million
views. Very popular.
It's been having a lot of impact. And there have been a number of videos like this recently. Where a YouTuber with a lot of followers makes a video about MH370 and it just gets millions and millions of hits. And then people are like, okay, this is, I think, what happened to the plane. But what they all sort of fall into in a similar typology as I see it, which is they boil the case down into about an hour, which this is now what, episode 28. I mean, we're in a lot more detail of that. And so they inevitably gloss over a lot of difficulties because it's a very complicated case. First of all, let me just ask you, like, what was your impression of the Mentor Pilot?
First of all, I should say that I do respect the guy. I think he's great for aviation. He does a lot of great videos. I think if you don't know this, maybe I've said this before, I've had a weird fascination with plane crashes since I was a kid because I had a fear of flying. And the way I got over it was why do planes crash? And learning why planes crash actually helped me understand how rare it is and how all the Swiss cheese model of probability and all of that. So I think this guy, I have deep respect for this guy. I've been watching this channel maybe 5 or 6 years or something like that. So I have deep respect for him. But I would say also that he seemed a little bit out of his depth regarding covering this. And it felt more like, well, I have to do this hour video. So what are just the high points that I need to hit? So he treated it more like an episode of Law and Order than actually a documentary where you cover the information until it's done, no matter if that takes 2 hours or 30 episodes of a podcast or whatever. So that was what I was left with.
That's interesting. You know, he himself, you know better than me because you've been watching him for years, but he is like a Czech captain for an airline. He's like a very experienced captain.
Absolutely.
And so he sees things through that captain lens. And so I thought it was kind of funny actually how he has a lengthy first part of the video where he talks about what time the pilots arrived and like what sort of like conversation they would have had and the checklist that they followed, and which is all speaks to his expertise, but it doesn't really bear on the mystery. Like,
it doesn't. If you watch his videos, he does that for everyone, no matter if it's a plane crash where a bunch of people got killed and, you know, there were mistakes made or whatever, or he covers things where planes almost crash and how the pilot saved it. So what he does every time, he takes a long look at what led up to the flight taking off, getting into the backgrounds of the pilots and everything. That's normal. That's pretty normal.
Got it. But he has a tendency to say things like, he has a tendency to sort of say, well, we don't really know what happened. But then he'll lay out hypothesis in like great detail that kind of make it sound like it really happened. Like he says, we don't know what happened to the passengers on the plane, but if they depressurized the plane, like all these things would have happened. So he kind of lays out the narrative having sort of given a disclaimer, he then sort of ignores the disclaimer and just like,
yeah, well, at the beginning of it, he goes, this is way more theorizing than I ever want to do. And it's true. And once again, having watched hundreds of his videos, maybe it's true. He did a way more theorizing in it. But I would say that in the end, I don't think it did much. I'm not saying he shouldn't have covered Flight 370. Maybe he should have just covered a little more factually instead of, jumping into things. Once again, my opinion, it's his channel. He can do what he wants.
Yeah. Sure. But there's two parts that I really wanted to shine a light on today. One of them is a sort of a hypothesis that has been floated by others. And I'll probably talk about some of the other similar video podcasts in other episodes of this show. But this idea that the plane was the 777 is an all electric plane. Like all of the flight surfaces are controlled by, the electrical system. There's a couple of direct linkages, but they're fairly minor. And so he posits that the pilot disconnected all of the electrical systems. And so the thing has no, and this is, and the thing that's crazy, first of all, as a pilot, he would know. This might be more obvious to a 777 pilot, but this is a really, really crazy and radical thing to do to your airplane. So if you disconnect the generators and you disconnect the APU in the back of the plane, you have no electrical power. There's like a little battery actually, but that doesn't give you much. And then this thing called the RAM air turbine drops down, and its propeller generates just enough electricity to let you control the flight surfaces. And it basically lets you see like your attitude indicator. So you're essentially flying blind. And this is a really, really radical thing to do that, so the question is, he never addresses, like, why would you do this? Like, why would you do such a radical thing? Again, it's like kind of gets back to the thing of like the guy walks on stage with a very voluminous coat and you're like, well, does he need a voluminous coat? It's like 72 degrees in this theater.
Right. That's right. That's right. Once again, I watched the video. Of course, I'm not a pilot. You're the pilot, Jeff. The host is the pilot. Yeah. I don't even know the last time I even rode on a Boeing 777. I don't think I ever have now that I think about it. I just know I take an interest in plane crashes and things, but even I know that's a very radical thing. And I know that if that's a theory and that little winds, that little windmill that pops up, that's not something good. Right.
No. No, your whole theory turns around a kind of a crazy assumption, which and the other thing is too is that like it's he does this thing that other people have done too, which is like you imagine that all the electrical power has been cut off, but then he's like, and then the air conditioning, he says the air conditioning must have worked because then otherwise the cockpit would have been too cold. I think he meant like HVAC or something, the idea is like he's like, well, the air conditioning must have been working, but I'm like, well, you just told us that the entire electrical power was cut to the entire plane. Like that's what you lose so many things that you take for granted. Right. Anyway,
again, I'm not a pilot. I'm not a Boeing 777 expert on how all of that stuff works, but I would say from a planning point of view, then, if we go back to talking about magic, is that planning something like this out, magicians who want to make things disappear and everything, they don't take a lot of risks. They have this all worked out beforehand and have practiced it over and over and over. And so we know that if the popular idea is that the main pilot, the head pilot on it, did something to the plane. The problem is we have no proof that he ever did any of this on his simulator, on somebody else's simulator, even read a book on what it would be like to fly like this. Well, if he never planned this, but his plan was also to ditch it in this, the Southern Indian Ocean, that seems like a risky thing to do if you really wanted to pull something off. Whereas my experience with people who want to pull things like that off is they go through all this sort of planning and everything beforehand. And so why would he take a risk like this that would not maybe get him to the point that he wanted to get to?
It's a huge risk for no apparent benefit.
Right.
That's a really great point.
Yes.
But so the most notable feature of this video that I wanted to t- talk about with you, Ed, is the video really puts a spotlight on an idea called WSPR, Whisper. It's pronounced Whisper. It stands for Weak Signal Propagation Reporter. And what even is this? Let me just explain this a little bit. It's a protocol for ham radio operators to record the strength of signals that they receive. And right, the way that ham radio works is that under certain atmospheric conditions, like a radio wave can bounce off the ionosphere and back, it bounces back and forth between the ionosphere and the surface of the Earth, and it can go like many, many thousands of miles. And so what they do is you, if you're part of this network, you can record the signal and you can kind of see where signals are getting to and how strong they are. And I guess, I don't really know what I'm talking about here, but I think they do it so that they can like sort of plan and know, like, if I'm in Switzerland, I want to talk to Australia. Is that going to work or not?
Yeah.
And so there's a whole database that this guy created, and the guy who invented it, is actually a Nobel. He won the Nobel Prize for work with like pulsars.
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it sounds like a very serious scientific thing. And there's this database that goes back for decades. And this guy's name is Joe Taylor. Okay. Joe Taylor won a Nobel Prize. And so along last year, along comes a guy named Richard Godfrey, who I've mentioned before in this podcast, and I actually have a long personal history with him. He was in the Independent Group. So was I. He was actually part of the effort to get me thrown out. So there's a certain controversy here.
Yeah.
I will cop to.
Yeah.
But he came out last year with a rather spectacular claim, which was that using science, he could use this Whisper database to figure out how MH-370 was flying, basically using it as a kind of primary radar. And Mentor Pilot does this thing where he says it's all very experimental and unproven. We can't really trust it. But then he basically endorses it. He basically says, this is very promising. It's getting better and better. And we need to, and this technology that Richard Godfrey has come up with, it basically tells us where we need to look. And we need to do that. He basically says the entire point of this video is to apply pressure to get the search restarted for the sake of the families.
Right.
So, Ed, the idea of Whisper is that apparently on the night that MH370 disappeared, there was some ham radio operators or some kind of transmitters operating between Switzerland and Australia. And there was a change in the magnitude of that signal that Richard Godfrey says that can tell us where, not only where MH370 was flying exactly, but what direction it was flying. And that is a claim that has gotten a lot of attention. There was even a BBC documentary that came out a few weeks ago, kind of repeating this claim. And the thing is, first of all, apparently, so Victor Ionella, who we've talked a lot about in this podcast a lot, on his website, and I'll put a link in the show notes, he looked at this claim and he's like, this is impossible. But I think it's like kind of intuitive. It's like, imagine a signal going from Switzerland to Australia. There's a lot of things in between Switzerland and Australia. And MH370 is just one of them. Every single airplane, there's like, at any given time, there's like thousands of airplanes flying around, right? So the idea that like a small change in the amplitude of the signal is going to tell you all these things is patently ridiculous. And so I think that for Mentor Pilot to say that, oh, this is promising technology that could give us answers, I think the answer is like pretty obviously no. But I think we don't really need to debate the technical aspects of it, because Victor Ionella reached out to this Nobel Prize winning scientist, Joe Taylor, and he asked him what he thought about it. And he said, quote, "As I've written several times before, it's crazy to think that historical Whisper data could be used to track the course of ill-fated flight MH370, or for that matter, any other aircraft flight. I don't choose to," this is where he kind of gets to the nub of it, "I don't choose to waste my time arguing with pseudoscientists who don't understand what they're doing." I mean, I think that's pretty unambiguous, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is like the headline of Mentor Pilot's show was
New Trace. So something
new
about
trace.
New Trace.
Yeah, it was called New Trace. And so basically he really foregrounded this idea. And even though in the course of his podcast, he says, like, this is unproven technology. I can't really put too much. He really actually, despite his, you know, disclaimers, really does foreground it.
Yeah. Essentially what he said at the end, once again, I want to say it again. I've watched this channel many times. I have a high respect for him as a host. I think he does a great job on his channel, but I'm no technical expert, but it seemed, didn't seem like solid technology to me. And it seemed to me that there was a huge amount of confirmation bias, that they went in wanting to find any sign that there was something going on in the Southern Indian Ocean. And guess what? They found it. How about that? You know, imagine that people who really already believe for no factual reason to think that it went into the Southern Indian Ocean and they happened to find some wave or whatever space and the wave got altered or whatever it was. Oh, that must be it. It sounds like a lot of confirmation bias, and being in the media as a reporter and doing disappearances, confirmation bias is something I deal with quite often in my podcast. It's a topic that comes up quite often. People thinking things for no factual reason, people believing things, wanting to believe in something being true are two totally different things. Run into it a lot with the work I do over the last 7.5 years. And it just, once again, I'm no technical expert. As soon as that part came out toward the end, I'm like, this doesn't sound solid at all. And it certainly doesn't sound like the thing that you'd invest, how much money was it? 30 million, 100 million, 300 million, whatever it was, to go out and look in the ocean again. Now, that sounds crazy.
Well, I think it's more than about just the money, though, too. I mean, because you could say, well, he's suggesting an area to look. What's the harm? Go look. But I think there is a potential harm that goes beyond just wasting money, which is that if you say to yourself, well, it's probably there, the southern scenario probably is valid. We just haven't found it. It's, this is sort of where the Australian official searchers left it off. They said their final report was, we didn't find it, but it's probably in this other area that we don't have time to search. And so they didn't. What this confirmation bias prevents you from doing, Ed, is from questioning that story, questioning the narrative, looking at the evidence and saying, well, are we really thinking about this right? Confirmation bias makes you not look at the facts, makes you not question, makes you not do stress testing of your hypothesis. And so.
Right. That's right. What I found interesting about this, of course, this guy is saying this is science. We have the people with all the Inmarsat data. Well, this is science. We have the biology people saying this is science.
Right.
And none of them agree.
Right.
So what is science exactly?
That is such a great point, Ed. And I think it really applies way beyond MHC. I mean, so much of the discourse in the public about so many things where people say, oh, the science says this. Science actually doesn't say anything. Science is a way that people argue with each other and consensus gradually forms. And it can be done badly, you know?
Yeah, it can. Yeah. It can be weaponized for sure. It can be weaponized. What caught my eye in that video toward the end was that allegedly this whisper showed like the jet flew in like a figure eight or something for a while before it crashed. And so, and being that you and I have known each other, it's going to come up on 7 years this summer. One of the first things we ever talked about was BTO and BFO data. First thing I thought of, well, if that's what it did, why didn't the BTO and BFO data show that? It didn't show anything like a figure eight.
No, not at all. I don't think it's probably physically possible. Ed, 7 years, that's really wild. And
it is.
And for many more, because it's been always fascinating hearing your ideas and bouncing things off you. You have a very interesting perspective. You've had a very interesting and varied life. And so, it's always great to hear you. You've been very generous with your time. You're a very busy guy. You're taking some time off your Sunday.
So
I want to thank you.
You're welcome.
I want to tell our viewers that, you know, what we've raised today is an interesting question we're going to get back to in future episodes. Who is Richard Godfrey? Why is he spreading these kind of elaborate stories about MH370? But in the next episode that Andy and I are going to be talking about is, what is the motive We've been talking a lot about maybe the plane went north. If it did, what would be the motive for that? And that's another thing that our listeners and viewers have really been kind of clamoring for and asking for. So that we're going to finally dive into that. But Ed, thank you again so much. And to our readers, I'm going to do, and listeners, I'm going to do something Andy normally does, which is say, I'm going to keep it briefer than what he does. I'm going to say, like, if you appreciate what we're doing, please hit like, subscribe. Ed, you probably do some version of this.
Yeah, if there's any, I have high respect for Jeff. Jeff, if I can do that, I remember I'm a big plane crash fan, so I can remember seeing you like 10 years ago in some of those some of those disaster shows.
Yeah.
And a plane crash. And it's been so great over the last 7 years to get to really know you and talk behind the scenes about Flight 370. It's really been a pleasure of mine. So I hope we can really continue that. Thank you.
Definitely, Ed. I really appreciate that. And to all the listeners and viewers, like I think something that I've always wanted to do is make this a discussion, a two-way conversation. Science is something that comes out of a community. And so I want people to discuss and like make up their mind and trade information. Science is not something that an individual person can do. I think that's underappreciated. So Ed, in that spirit, thank you so much. I'm grateful to you. I'm grateful to you. We've had some technical issues here and you've been very patient. So, but we'll see you next time. And watch his show, Unfound. It's a great show.
Unfound on Spotify and iTunes. Yep.
Okay. Check it out. And we'll put a link in the show page too. All right. Bye everybody.